and began a bachelor's program after I finished my 2 years in the Army. Law enforcement interested me greatly, and as a consequence, my grades steadily improved. After completing the undergraduate program, I was accepted for graduate work. I finished only one semester of that, though, before I went back into the Army, this time as an officer, having been in ROTC while at Michigan State University. I had attempted to get a job on the Chicago Police Force, only to be told that the force wasn't interested in recruits with too much schooling because they might make too much trouble. The chairman of our school had some influence, but the best Chicago would offer, my Chicago patrolman brother-in-law Frank Grasser told me privately, was a patrolman's job, which I could have obtained with only a high school education. Frank continued to encourage my interest in law enforcement. The Army, however, offered me a position as a lieutenant in the MPs and a post in Germany. That intrigued me because both my wife and I were of German extraction, and we leapt at the chance to go to the land of our forefathers. I was fortunate enough to receive a choice assignment, that of provost marshal of a platoon of MPs in Aschaffenburg. The town had a population of about 45,000, and our garrison held about 8,000, so I became, in effect, the chief of police for a small town. There were homicides, burglaries, arson cases, the whole gamut of problems that a police chief would see. After 4 years, when I was ready to get out of the Army again, I was offered another plum assignment as commander of a criminal investigation division, CID, unit based at Fort Sheridan, just outside of Chicago, a plainclothes investigations unit responsible for operations in military jurisdictions in 5 surrounding states. I supervised men in and around Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and so on. Contrary to what the general public often thinks about the military, that inside such an organization, talent and drive get lost, the Army has developed ways of trying to intrigue and retain good people by watching them closely and offering them good assignments. I had twice already been the beneficiary of their interest. As I discovered later, the assignment at Fort Sheridan was similar to running one of the FBI's field offices. All my agents wore civilian clothes, carried credentials, a badge, and a .38. In fact, we frequently worked with the local police and the FBI. In Aschaffenburg, as a lieutenant, I had replaced a senior captain. At Fort Sheridan, as a first lieutenant, still quite a junior officer, I replaced a major. One of our largest cases involved my bringing in some agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, later known as the Drug Enforcement Agency, to Fort Sheridan to penetrate a narcotics ring. The agents posed as troublemaking enlisted men who had been posted to Fort Sheridan while they awaited dishonorable discharges. The ring was infiltrated, but not without some danger. The undercover men were on the verge of being set up to be ripped off and murdered when we learned of the proposed hit. The finale of the affair was right out of the movies. As all units at the fort were mustered in the company streets for a final inspection before everyone was to get a 3-day pass, my units and those of the FBN and the FBI surrounded the area with cars, trucks, and machine guns. The undercover men stepped out of ranks, pinned on their badges, and accompanied the commanding officer through the ranks, fingering the dope dealers, who were then led away to the brig. The whole affair left me feeling as if I would like to continue this sort of work for the government, but as a civilian with the FBI. As commander of the CID unit, I frequently was the host at liaison parties for the various policing agencies with whom we routinely interacted, including the FBI. There were lots of FBI-type cases in those days, the mid-1960s. On college campuses, there were the beginnings of riots and other anti-establishment activities, some of which spread to young people the same age as college students who were on nearby military bases. My CID agents worked their way into groups that were planning disruptive activities and reported back with what they had seen, not just to me, but also to the FBI. Lest the listener think that this was much ado about nothing, I should point out that one of these groups had stolen explosives from Fort Sheridan and was interrupted while planning to bomb some military targets. Several years later, after I had joined the FBI, I had occasion to do research into these old cases and learned that the Bureau people in the Chicago field office of the FBI had taken credit for the work of my CID investigators. That was a first and somewhat rude insight into how the FBI sometimes went about its business. There was what FBI insiders called a one-way street in operation. The FBI took from other law enforcement agencies, but gave back nothing, ever. I was due to be discharged from the Army and was looking for a way to go further in law enforcement when my status was frozen as a result of the escalation of the war in Vietnam. No one of my rank in my part of the armed services was allowed to leave just then. The Army came to me with an interesting proposition. Someone higher up in the service had looked over my records and had seen that I had completed a semester of graduate work. The Army now offered to pay me to complete my master's in police administration and to continue my salary while I studied, in exchange for signing up for an additional 2-year hitch after I finished the master's program. This time, at Michigan State, I had a wife and 2 children along, and in addition to my studies, a secret assignment from the Army, undercover work within the groups that were actively resisting the Vietnam War. I grew my hair long and went to SDS and various New Left meetings, including marches and so on. Painting myself as a disgruntled veteran, I attended organizational get-togethers and other meetings. There's even a picture of me in a campus newspaper somewhere, long-haired, and with my infant daughter perched on my shoulder for additional cover. We were protesting CIA recruiting on campus. I wonder whether that picture of me ended up in the CIA files. I thought these radical protesters didn't know what they were talking about. They hadn't been in the military, didn't know what the military was doing, but were determined that the military was their enemy. Often they seemed to want to disrupt things just for the joy of making a mess. One assistant professor of psychology was hanging around these same meetings, trying to motivate students to protest the war, even suggesting to them that they massively enroll in ROTC in an attempt to disrupt the system. He counseled that while in classes they should make things difficult for the instructors by asking dumb questions, and that at the time they were supposed to graduate, they refused to take commissions in the armed forces. The assistant professor was soon advised to get a job somewhere else. The classes went quickly and well. Among my cohorts in the graduate program was Ken Joseph, then the senior resident agent of the Lansing, Michigan FBI office. Ken stayed on to finish his doctorate while I went back into the Army to fulfill my obligation. After finishing my degree, I served for a year as a provost marshal in Thailand, and another year as deputy provost marshal at Fort Sheridan. By now I was a major, and seriously had to consider continuing on in the military as a career. But my friends in the FBI convinced me to reinstate the application I had made earlier, just before my position in the military had been frozen, and to come into the Bureau. The alternative didn't seem as attractive in 1970, when I was 32, as it had been in 1967, but I certainly liked the sort of investigations I knew the FBI to be conducting. So I applied in earnest and was accepted. Several of my commanders in the Army tried to talk me out of leaving and touted my prospects for advancement with the CID, but I was enthralled by the prospect of becoming a special agent of the FBI and was no longer listening to reason. I was in trouble in the FBI from the first half hour of my tenure. I had received a letter telling me to report to a room in the old post office building at 8 on a Monday morning in February 1970, and arrived there at 7:50 a.m., bright and eager, only to find a note posted announcing that the class had been transferred to a room at the Department of Justice building, some blocks away. Hustling there, I was met in the halls by agent counselors, who, upon learning my name, told me that everything was about to hit the fan, and that I should be worried. In the classroom, an instructor was droning on about bureau insurance and retirement matters, and he halted the class to tell me that I was late. I stood my ground, saying that I had been 10 minutes early and had had no prior notice that the location had been changed. He couldn't deal with that and sent me to a high bureau official. J. Edgar Hoover was still alive and firmly in charge at that time, and Joe Casper, deputy assistant director of the training division, was an old Hoover hand. Although Casper was nicknamed the Ghost for the cartoon character Casper the Friendly Ghost, he was anything but friendly. I reiterated my argument to him that I had been on time, but that the location had been changed. The Ghost tried to tell me that everyone had been sent a letter advising them of the room change, and I replied that all I had was the letter telling me to go to the old post office building. He wanted me to admit that I was wrong and had disobeyed orders, and I wasn't going to do that. I informed the official that I'd been in the Army for quite some time and knew all about orders, both giving and receiving them. I thought steam was going to come out of the Ghost's ears as he threatened me with being kicked out of the FBI that very minute. I responded by saying that perhaps that would be best for everyone. If the FBI was such a nitpicking outfit that it didn't know how to treat new agents who had been so actively recruited, the Army would take me back in a minute, no questions asked. "Raise your goddamn right hand," Casper said to me, and proceeded to swear me in, to advise me to shut my mouth, and to warn me that we'll be watching you from that moment on. It was a typical attempt to intimidate a new agent, but I was a little older, a little wiser, and a little more used to the ways of a military or quasi-military bureaucracy than the average recruit, and so stood it reasonably well. This experience left me, however, with a bad taste in my mouth for the do-it-by-the-book stodginess and inflexibility of the Bureau, an attitude I would continue to fight from that day until my retirement 20 years later. New agents Class 70-2 was counseled by two experienced agents in their mid-40s who aspired to higher management in the Bureau and who, as part of getting their tickets punched, had to manage a class of new agents successfully through 16 weeks of training. As I learned, theirs was a high-risk-for-high-gain proposition. For if the new agents didn't pan out, the counselors could be headed for oblivion rather than for desk jobs at headquarters. Joe, O.C. Joe O'Connell, was known for his work against organized crime figures. A multi-million-dollar lawsuit was pending against him for bugging mob members. The lawsuit was ultimately dismissed. He didn't seem worried about that, but he did have a bee in his bonnet about the white shirts, his non-affectionate name for headquarters supervisors. These supervisors would come to lecture about various violations of the laws that FBI agents were to administer, and after one had come and gone, O.C. Joe would tell us to throw away the notes we had just taken, and that he would help us prepare for the test on that particular law. He also told anyone that needed extra help to see him in the hall. Today, I look back and recognize that those agents who did regularly see O.C. Joe in the hall for additional guidance because they truly needed help were nevertheless the ones who progressed well up the management ladder, while many smarter agents toiled in the field for years and never made supervisor. The other counselor was Bud Abbott, nicknamed Shaky because of his nervousness. What he was nervous about was the anti-establishment attitude of O.C. Joe. Because the two men shared this particular class, their fates were tied to one another, and Shaky, a rather standard bureaucrat, was worried that O.C. Joe's antics would sabotage his own attempts to land a headquarters job. Eventually, both men went on to higher management, so I guess we must have done well enough to satisfy the powers above. After training, I put in several years of field work as a special agent based at the FBI offices in Chicago, New Orleans, and Cleveland. During those years of the early 1970s, the Bureau had opened the new FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, the last positive legacy of J. Edgar Hoover, who had championed the building of what was to be the world's finest training facility for law enforcement personnel. Ken Joseph had been tapped to come to headquarters and help in the setting up of the Quantico programs, and in 1974 he pulled me in from Cleveland. At the FBI National Academy, FBINA, I began as a class counselor for the visiting policemen. Each instructor handled about 50 students, shepherding them through the several-month program. By June of 1974, I was convinced that I should make a stay at Quantico part of my FBI resume. The academic environment was attractive, as was the beautiful Virginia countryside, and I also thought that a stint at Quantico was imperative if I was to go up the ladder into higher FBI management. Another factor luring me to Quantico was the fledgling behavioral sciences unit, then consisting mainly of two senior men, Howard Teton and Pat Mullaney, a Mutt and Jeff team. They always taught together and were quite a pair, with Teton the 6'7", thin, straight man, and Mullaney the 5'10", slightly chubby comic. Teton, quiet, low-key, and methodical, and Mullaney, quick and energetic, devoted most of their time to teaching, but now and then analyzed a violent crime and profiled the appearance and behavior of likely suspects. They were my mentors in profiling, and within a few years when they retired, I took up the mantle of chief profiler. Learning to profile was an ongoing process, part of trying to understand the violent criminal mind, something I was also pursuing personally in another way in my lectures at Quantico about abnormal and criminal psychology. The people who commit crimes against other people, crimes that have nothing to do with money, are a different breed from the ordinary criminals whose motivation is profit. Murderers, rapists, and child molesters aren't seeking monetary profit from their crimes. In a perverse, though sometimes understandable way, they are seeking emotional satisfaction. That makes them different, and, to me, that makes them interesting. At Quantico, I taught subjects ranging from abnormal psych to interviewing techniques, and I discovered that I was a pretty good teacher. I also learned that I liked being an instructor. We got to go on the road for our training sessions, both nationally and sometimes internationally, and while travel can be wearing, we did journey to some interesting places overseas and met a great many law enforcement personnel. It was at one of these international sessions that I coined the term serial killer, now much in use. At that time, killings such as those of Son of Sam killer David Berkowitz in New York were invariably labeled stranger killings. This term didn't seem appropriate to me, however, for sometimes killers do know their victims. Various other terms had also been used, but none hit the nail on the head. I'd been invited to participate in a week of lectures at Bramshill, the British Police Academy, and while there I took the opportunity to attend the other seminars and lectures. In one of them, a man was discussing what the Brits called crimes in series, a series of rapes, burglaries, arsons, murders. That seemed a highly appropriate way of characterizing the killings of those who do one murder, then another, and another in a fairly repetitive way. And so, in my classes at Quantico and elsewhere, I began referring to serial killers. The nomenclature didn't seem to be a big deal at the time. It was part of our overall effort in trying to get a handle on these monstrous crimes, of seeking ways of comprehending them, so we could move more quickly toward apprehending the next serial killer. Now that I look back on that naming event, I think that what was also in my mind were the serial adventures we used to see on Saturday at the movies. The one I liked best was The Phantom. Each week you'd be lured back to see another episode, because at the end of each one there was a cliffhanger. In dramatic terms, this wasn't a satisfactory ending, because it increased, not lessened, the tension. The same dissatisfaction occurs in the minds of serial killers. The very act of killing leaves the murderer hanging, because it wasn't as perfect as his fantasy. When the Phantom is left sinking in the quicksand, the viewer has to come back next week to see how the hero gets out of difficulty. After a murder, the serial murderer thinks of how the crime could have been bettered. "Good heavens, I killed her too quickly. I didn't take time to have enough fun, to torture her properly. Should have approached her a new way, thought up a different way of sexually assaulting her." When he follows this sort of train of thought, his mind jumps ahead to how he can kill more nearly perfectly the next time. There's an improvement continuum. That's not how the public imagines serial killers, however. Most people conceive of the murderer as being a kind of Jekyll and Hyde. One day he's normal, and on the next a physiological drive is taking hold. His hair is growing, his fangs are lengthening, so that when the moon is full, he'll have to seize another victim. Serial killers are not like that. They are obsessed with a fantasy, and they have what we must call non-fulfilled experiences that become part of the fantasy and push them on toward the next killing. That's the real meaning behind the term serial killer. Between 1975 and 1977, I became involved in teaching hostage negotiation techniques. The Bureau had been quite a bit behind the New York City Police Department, the leader in understanding and dealing with hostage situations. However, it had succeeded in extracting a good deal of information about such situations from the New York City experts, Captain Frank Bowles and Detective Harvey Schlossberg. We expanded and taught the techniques to law enforcement agencies throughout the country. As an Army Reserve officer, I also taught such techniques to MP and CID contingents, and I estimate that over the past 15 years I have actually instructed about 90% of those in the U.S. Army throughout the world who are trained in hostage negotiations. It was an interesting time in law enforcement. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, a large number of men came out of the military, ex-Green Berets, and other men schooled in the jungles of Vietnam and went into police forces. Their skill and expertise with weaponry and assault tactics became the basis of SWAT teams, an entirely new concept in American law enforcement. A SWAT team is essentially a paramilitary force, and we'd never had such forces before. Even in the FBI, where agents were trained in the use of rifles and machine guns as well as pistols, until these years there had been little attention paid to the paramilitary aspects of making a raid. SWAT teams were sexy, however, and drew media attention. SWAT teams used snipers to kill criminals, and such heavy weaponry as assault rifles and grenade launchers in their attempts to storm hideouts or to rescue hostages. The problem was that these tactics were producing a lot of carnage. Mostly, criminals were being killed, but police officers were also going down in record numbers, and there were a fair number of hostages hurt as well. The NYPD had started its hostage negotiation team in an effort to avoid the carnage, and the FBI quickly embraced the idea of advocating a softer approach to hostage situations. I liked this approach because it emphasized the need to understand the criminal mind, which was my own hobby horse and, of course, was the basis for profiling. At that time, law enforcement people were unprepared for an understanding approach. Most police lacked any real training in psychology and were more prone to think in terms of using force than using persuasion. However, as the FBI took over the teaching of hostage negotiation techniques and added its own spin, the whole trend of using SWAT teams turned around, and so did the number of deaths in hostage situations. It became accepted practice to talk first and to avoid using weaponry whenever possible. This approach was also midwifed into existence by some lawsuits against various police jurisdictions for undue use of force. Lawsuits that cost cities millions of dollars. These soon translated into mandates to exhaust all nonviolent avenues before resorting to SWAT team assaults. Within a decade, the behavioral approach to crime would go far beyond hostage negotiation and profiling, into the establishment of the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime and the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. I was at the forefront of nurturing into existence both the NCAVC and VICAP. But I'm getting ahead of my story, and so will leave those developments for a later chapter. While I was in Cleveland as instructor of a traveling school, a roadshow as we called it, I became involved in a hostage negotiation crisis. A black gunman held a police captain and a 17-year-old girl hostage inside the Warrensville Heights police station, and we were trying to talk everyone out and avoid bloodshed. Somehow, the gunman's demands had been made public. Among them were that he wanted all white people immediately to leave the face of the earth, and he wanted to speak with President Jimmy Carter about this. Since these particular demands were clearly not rational, I made no attempt to meet them. At the command site, I was handed a telephone and told that someone important wanted to speak to me. It was Jody Powell, the president's press secretary, who informed me that the White House had learned of the situation and that President Carter was ready to speak to the terrorist. Dumbfounded, I told Powell that we had no terrorists in Cleveland. Trying to be polite, yet incredulous that the White House would even think to intervene in such a delicate situation, I lied to Powell and told him that we were unable to raise the gunman on the phone just then. If we had need of the president, I said, we'd call back. The situation was resolved without bloodshed and without presidential intervention. I was in charge of the FBI's hostage training for just 2 years, but continued to be involved in the area for many years after 1977, mostly as the chief resident terrorist. At a remote desert atomic facility in 1978, at Lake Placid in the early 1980s, and at other sites throughout that decade, major law enforcement agencies of our government and of some foreign countries participated in full-scale, week-long simulations of terrorist attacks and subsequent hostage negotiations. On several of these exercises, I played the part of the head terrorist. We would hijack a busload of volunteers who played important people, scientists or visiting dignitaries, for example, and take them to an isolated farm or ski lodge where we would hold them hostage. Real guns, grenades, dynamite, and other weapons were used, and when I demanded an airliner to fly us out of the country, one was commandeered and delivered to the nearest airstrip. Once the exercise had begun, we were in earnest about it and stayed in character. At Lake Placid, I was 10, while an FBI machine gun expert was 20, and the parts of 30, 40, 50, and 60 were taken by men from the CIA, the Secret Service, the Army's Delta Force, and from the British counterpart of that Delta Force, the SAS. These simulations were so realistic that some hostages became subject to the Stockholm Syndrome, in which the hostage so identifies with the hostage takers that he or she is willing to act with them in order to survive. The men on the other side of the telephone from me, negotiating for the FBI, were former students of mine who sometimes complained that I was too tough an adversary because I knew and countered all of their tricks. In each exercise, however, the good guys did manage to retake the hostages and the terrorists, though not always without simulated bloodshed. That I had gotten into teaching hostage negotiating techniques at all in the mid-1970s was a sign of restlessness on my part. Not entirely comfortable with repeating the same lessons in classes all the time, I thirsted for new challenges. Many of my fellow instructors at Quantico were not interested in looking for something new to do. Innovation is discouraged in most bureaucracies, and the FBI is no exception, though management claimed they always encouraged instructors to improve their techniques and presentation. A lot of guys were perfectly content to teach canned cases, the majority of which they had inherited from an earlier generation of instructors. My colleague, John Minderman, called such instructors oil slicks, because they covered a lot of territory, but only at a depth of a millimeter or so. Minderman, a former San Francisco motorcycle policeman, taught me a good deal about how to relate to the police officers who made up the bulk of our classes. Most of the cases I expounded upon in my criminology lectures were not canned, but widely known cases where the basic information came from sources available to the public. Books and articles about Charles Manson, Sirhan Sirhan, David Berkowitz, the Texas Tower Killer, Charles Whitman, and so on, formed the basis of our arsenal. Studying these cases intently, I began to see that our classes were not presenting original or unique information on these killers, principally because none was readily available. The books on Manson had been written from the point of view of the prosecuting attorney, or from a gleaning of media coverage and interviews with ancillary members of Manson's entourage. Where was the unique understanding of the mind of Manson that a police officer would want to gain from having attended a course on criminal psychology at the world's leading facility for the teaching of law enforcement? Most people viewing the Manson cases from the outside had long ago decided that Manson was crazy and that nothing further could be gained from studying what he had done. What if he wasn't precisely crazy? Would that mean there was new understanding to be gotten from the Manson-inspired murders? Unfortunately, that question couldn't be answered, because all we had to go on was what everyone else had. On Richard Speck, killer of 8 nurses in Chicago, the material was somewhat better, a book written by a psychiatrist who had done extensive interviews with him. Even these interviews were inadequate, though, because the man who had conducted them did not have the background in dealing with criminals or the need to understand matters from a law enforcement perspective that would be necessary for our students. I wanted to better understand the mind of the violent criminal, first of all, to satisfy my own curiosity, but also in order to become a better teacher, so that our classes at the FBI Academy would be more highly prized by the police personnel who attended them. At the time that I came to this conclusion, the FBI was almost completely uninterested in murderers, rapists, child molesters, and other criminals who prey on their fellow men. Most of these violent behavior cases fell entirely within the jurisdiction of local law enforcement agencies and were not violations of the federal laws that the FBI was charged with enforcing. At the Academy, we did teach criminology to visiting police officers, so the study of the criminal mind was a relevant exercise for me, but in the eyes of most of my colleagues and superiors, it was only barely relevant. They wanted no part of it. Conversely, I became deeply intrigued by it. I was encouraged in pursuing my interests by people I met at the conferences and conventions I was beginning to attend, gatherings of professionals in mental health and related fields. My curiosity brought me into the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law, among others. None of my colleagues at the FBI saw any value in associations like these, and the Bureau did not consider them particularly worthwhile either. For many years, I paid all my dues as a member of these and other organizations myself, although the Bureau occasionally did reimburse me for attendance at professional conferences. The Bureau's avoidance of mental health professionals was of a piece with the Bureau's belief that if there was something worth knowing about criminals, the Bureau already knew it. I had a different view, a sense that there was a great deal to be learned, and that many experts outside of law enforcement could teach us things we didn't know. Certainly, my outlook and horizons expanded when I attended professional conferences and, later, was invited to speak at them and share my work with people other than police officials. Meeting psychiatrists, psychologists, people active in caring for victims of violent crime, and other mental health professionals gave me the impetus to look further into doing the sort of research that I was uniquely positioned to do. As I traveled around the country doing road schools, I began to drop in at local police departments and ask them for copies of case files on particularly violent offenders, rapists, child molesters, murderers. Because of my years of liaison work with policing agencies, I was able to talk rather easily with the various authorities and to obtain such information. If I was interested in a case, when an officer from the jurisdiction involved in that case showed up for training at Quantico, I'd assign them the task of assembling their department's files on the case for their own mini-research report, and would gratefully accept a copy of the materials for my own private, burgeoning file cabinets of data. People were so cooperative, so interested in the idea of trying to systematize what we knew and didn't know about violent criminals, that they sent me reams of stuff. In a way, their cooperation was a recognition of our great need for information and for understanding in this area. At around this time, I came across a quotation from Nietzsche that stuck with me. It seemed to pinpoint both the fascination I had with this research and the dangers it posed. Thereafter, I put it on a slide that I always showed during my lectures and presentations. Here it is. "Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And when you look into an abyss, the abyss also looks into you." It was important for me to keep such sobering thoughts in mind as I proceeded to muck about in the depths of human criminality. As a result of my inquiries and requests for information, I soon had far more factual files on violent criminals than were available to the news media or any local police department, and I had more of them than anyone else, perhaps because very few people were asking for them. As the quotation suggests, dealing with monsters entails problems. Then, too, other seekers encountered a procedural difficulty. Academics couldn't obtain police files as easily as an FBI man could, and they had often been discouraged from trying. So I was in a privileged position from which to undertake this research. In the office and at home, I pored over this material, gaining occasional new insights from it, systematically analyzing it, and began to get a feeling for the possibilities of doing in-depth research that would lead to a greater understanding of violent offenders. At last, I came to the point where I wanted very much to talk to the people about whom I'd been lecturing, the killers themselves. I discussed this idea with John Minderman, and we decided we'd have a go at it. We wanted to learn more about what factors in the killer's environment, childhood, and background made him want to commit such crimes. And we also wanted to know many more details about the crimes themselves. What happened during the assault? What went on immediately after the killer was certain that the victim had died? How had he chosen the site for disposal of the body? If we got enough information from enough interviewees, we'd be able to compile useful lists. So many took souvenirs. So many read or viewed pornographic materials. Then, too, there were some old chestnuts in regard to murder that we wanted to test. For instance, whether killers really did return to the scenes of their crimes. Grace Hopper, a naval admiral and computer expert, had come to Quantico to give a lecture, and she was especially eloquent in describing her strategies for dealing with the bureaucracy of the Navy when she wanted to get something innovative accomplished. She said that the basis of her success in neutralizing the bureaucracy was the axiom, "It is better to ask forgiveness than to ask permission." Once something was out on paper in a request format, Hopper said, if it was then denied, the project was dead. But if it's not on paper, well, you get the idea. To avoid being stopped before I got started, I thought that I'd better go ahead with my pet project to interview some killers and not tell anyone in a supervisory capacity about it. In early 1978, I was to go to Northern California to teach at a Rhodes School, and I saw a window of opportunity. Agent John Conway, who had been in one of my classes at Quantico, was stationed in San Rafael and was the Bureau's liaison officer to the California prison system. I asked Conway to locate certain offenders in the California prisons and when I arrived for my week of teaching, he had all the information ready for me. As bureau agents, we could enter any prison in the country just by showing our badges to the prison authorities. And once inside, we didn't have to explain why we wished to interview any particular offender. So, on a Friday, after 4 days of teaching, Conway and I took off on a whirlwind tour of prisons and inmates that lasted through the weekend and into the next week. In one swoop, we interviewed 7 of the most dangerous and notorious murderers ever apprehended in the United States. Sirhan Sirhan, Charles Manson, Tex Watson, a Manson associate, Juan Corona, killer of many migrant workers, Herbert Mullen, who had killed 14 people, John Frazier, who had killed 6, and Edmund Kemper. Interviewing convicted killers in this way had never been done before, and was a breakthrough of rare proportions. My first interview was with Sirhan Sirhan in Soledad. The prison authorities put Conway and me in a fairly large room, one that appeared to be used for staff meetings. It was not really intimate enough for my purposes, but we made do. Sirhan entered the room with his eyes wild, frightened, and apprehensive. He stood against the wall with his fist clenched and refused to shake hands. He demanded to know what we wanted from him. He believed that if we were really FBI agents, we were probably consorting with the Secret Service, who regularly conducted interviews with assassins. The Secret Service's interviews were conducted for reasons unrelated to ours. At the time of his conviction for the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Sirhan had been diagnosed as exhibiting all the signs of paranoid schizophrenia. Now we were seeing why. He didn't want to let us use a tape recorder and wanted to talk to a lawyer. I told him this was all informal and preliminary and that we were just there to talk. To coax Sirhan out of his fright, I asked him about the prison system itself, and that got his motor going. He was annoyed at a former cellmate who had betrayed him by speaking to an interviewer from Playboy. Slowly he began to relax his fist, to edge closer to the table where Conway and I sat, and eventually to sit down, and be somewhat more at ease. He told me, for instance, that he had heard voices that told him to assassinate the senator, and that once, when he had been looking into a mirror, he had felt his face cracking and falling in pieces to the floor. Both of these were consistent with a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. When he got rolling, Sirhan always referred to himself in the third person. Sirhan did this. Sirhan felt that. He said that he was in protective custody not because the prison authorities feared for his life, which was the actual case, but because the authorities were treating him with more respect than they accorded common thieves and child molesters. Sirhan is an Arab who grew up in a war zone, and his motivations and orientation had much to do with those facts. Out of the blue, for instance, he asked me whether Mark Felt was a Jew. Felt was a high-ranking, high-profile assistant director of the FBI. The question from Sirhan reflected his beliefs about the world. Sirhan said that he had learned that Senator Kennedy supported the selling of more jet fighter planes to Israel, and that by assassinating Kennedy, Sirhan had prevented the elevation to the presidency of a man who would continue to befriend Israel. And therefore he, Sirhan, had changed world history and helped the Arab countries. He believed that the parole board was afraid to put him back on the streets because they feared his personal magnetism. He preferred, if released, to go back to Jordan, where, he was certain, people would pick him up on their shoulders and parade him through the streets as a hero. He saw himself as having done something that was not correctly understood at the time, but that would become clear only in historical perspective. Sirhan had studied political science in college, and told me he had wanted to be a diplomat, to work in our State Department, and eventually become an ambassador. He admired the Kennedys, but he shot one of the Klan. The psychotic desire to fuse oneself through assassination with a notable figure is common among men such as Sirhan, John Hinckley, Mark Chapman, and Arthur Bremer. Sirhan knew that 10 years in prison was about the average that one spent for such a crime in the United States, and therefore he felt that now, in 1978, he should be released. He believed he had good potential for being rehabilitated, unless he remained in jail too long. At the end of the interview, he stood at the door, sucking in his stomach, flexing his muscles, giving me a profile of his magnificence. He had done quite a bit of weightlifting and was somewhat sculpted. He said, "Well, Mr. Wrestler, what do you think of Sirhan now?" I didn't answer the question, and Sirhan was then taken away. Obviously, he felt that to know Sirhan was to love him. The schizoid aspects of his behavior had diminished in prison, but not the paranoia. Sirhan refused any further interviews with us for the program. Frazier, Mullen, and Corona all fell quite completely into the disorganized category of killers and were nearly so mentally strange that I hardly got anywhere with them at all. Corona was entirely uncommunicative, and Frazier was a prisoner of his delusions. Mullen was docile and polite, but really had nothing to say. I had better luck with Charles Manson, Tex Watson, and the others, who could most definitely be placed in the category of organized killers. Though Manson and his associates had taken pains to make their murders appear as if some disorganized personality had committed them. Before going to see any of these killers, I had, of course, done a great deal of research into them and their crimes, and as a result had obtained rather deep knowledge of each man. This stood me especially well in regard to Manson. He wanted to know, as he entered the interview area, what the FBI wanted with him and why he should talk to us. Once I had convinced him that I was interested in him as a human being, I got a very good response, for Manson is a great talker, and his favorite subject is himself. I discovered him to have a complex, wonderfully manipulative personality, and learned a great deal about how he perceived himself in relation to the world, and how he had manipulated those who killed for him. Far from insane, he had keen insight into his crimes and into the personalities and rationales of those who had been fatally attracted to his charismatic presence. The information gleaned from this preliminary interview with Manson was more than I'd hoped for, and certified to me that doing such interviews in depth would result in whole new insights into the behavior of such killers. There was nothing in the literature to compare with what I was getting from the killer himself. Formerly, I and everyone else looking into these matters had been on the outside of a killer's mind looking in. Now, I was gaining a unique perspective from the inside of that mind looking out. I'll tell the story of the interview with Manson and subsequent interviews with killers in detail in the next chapters. But for the present, I want to bring forward the narrative of how the interviewing of murderers was brought into the rather rigid structure of the FBI. About halfway through the week of interviewing, and perhaps as a consequence of dealing with these strange, driven men, I began to become a bit paranoid myself, thinking that I had no sanction from the Bureau to be conducting these interviews, and therefore needed a way to cut the Bureau in on them. I should have had prior permission to go and see such well-known inmates as Manson or Sirhan, but I didn't. I figured I was just doing preliminary interviews, not even taking notes, and was just requesting permission from these men to come back later with a tape recorder. But, nonetheless, I should have had something on paper. I had violated a cardinal principle of the Bureau and had done something without authorization. Actually, agents in the Bureau are divided into two camps by the way they go about their business. There are the majority who ask permission for everything they do because they don't want to get in trouble with the hierarchy. To my way of thinking, such agents are basically insecure. The second group, a much smaller bunch, consists of those who never ask permission to do anything because they want to get things accomplished. I was firmly in the second camp, and was getting prepared to pay the consequences for my brash actions. Following Admiral Hopper's rule, I hoped that if and when I was called on the carpet, I'd devise a strategy for dealing with that eventuality. When I got back to Quantico, however, I was so excited by the new information that I decided to make another run before putting things down on paper, at which point my project could very likely be deep-sixed forever. It was the spring of 1978. Not too far away from Quantico was the women's reformatory at Alderson, West Virginia. Two of Manson's girls, Squeaky Fromm and Sandra Good, were incarcerated there, as well as Sarah Jane Moore, who had tried to assassinate President Gerald Ford. I could interview them all in a day. Minderman was going through a divorce and decided to return to his home in San Francisco as an FBI squad supervisor. I needed a backup to replace him, and I chose John Douglas, a young, flamboyant agent whom I had earlier championed into the BSU after he had completed a stint at Quantico as a visiting counselor. I decided to tell my immediate superior, Larry Monroe, what I was going to do. Larry was upset. "You talk to who in California? You're going to interview who in West Virginia?" I told him not to worry, that after I came back, I'd put the whole thing on paper. And Larry made a typical middle management response. He agreed to let us go to West Virginia on the condition that, if as a result, anything bad happened bureaucratically, he would be able to claim that he had known nothing about it and that it was all my fault. Since it certainly was my fault all the way, I had no problem with this condition. We talked to all three women and got some good information. Basically, Fromm and Good bolstered the ideas I had been forming about Manson and his influence, which had been based on my preliminary interviews with Manson and with Tex Watson. When I got back to Quantico, my own actions could be called serial. I now hoped to perfect my crimes by doing still more interviews before I had to face the paper hangman. This strategy was cut short by an accidental leak, however. One of my friends, to whom I had bragged a bit about my exploits, happened to be gossiping about them to someone else in the lunchroom, and didn't realize that Ken Joseph was within earshot. Ken was, by now, the director of the FBI Academy, and even though he was my mentor, he was the chief administrator, a fan of the late Director Hoover, and of his belief that the hierarchy had to be kept informed at all times of what was going on in the ranks. Now he had to act as a high official was obliged by this heritage to do in the face of what was clearly unauthorized behavior by one former Michigan State pal, Robert Ressler. Larry Monroe and I were called onto the carpet in Ken's office and asked why he had not been advised of this Ressler initiative. Fortunately for me, a month or two earlier, Joseph had put out a memo that for the first time encouraged instructors to do research, and I told him that my project, a preliminary project, I stressed, had been in response to that memo. Now, this wasn't entirely true, and I think all three of us knew that. But we went on without acknowledging that fact. Ken bored in, pointing out that interviewing significant people such as Sirhan and Manson could incur liabilities for the Bureau. I replied that I had put my intentions in a memo and circulated that before I'd gone off to California. Ken said he'd never seen that memo, and I blithely suggested that I'd have to see whether a copy could be located in the files somewhere so I could show it to him. Larry Monroe kept an appropriately straight face through all of this, and so did Ken Joseph, and you can be sure that no smile creased my visage either. We were engaged in a bureaucratic tap dance well known to the people who toil in government offices. When we left Joseph's carpet, I knew I must now write and backdate that memo, double-quick. I wrote an appropriate memo suggesting that I was going to do some pilot work in preparation for a major program of interviewing serial killers. Going to the prisons of California was merely to test the waters, to learn whether these convicted killers would be willing to participate in the research. I then crumpled up the memo, stepped on it a few times, Xeroxed that, then Xeroxed the copy, stuck it in the files, then retrieved it, and took it up to Ken Joseph, saying that it must have previously been misfiled and had now luckily been located. That, of course, was not hard for Joseph to believe, since things get misfiled all the time. Moreover, since Joseph was basically in agreement on my idea to interview the inmates, he was willing to play the game properly. Now that we had justified the pilot project, Ken wanted me to write up a complete memo that laid out the true dynamics and dimensions of the actual interviewing project, replete with ground rules for conducting the interviews, liaisons with outside professionals and academic institutions, and so on. I was pleased to do that, and drafts of the proposal went back and forth between me, Larry Monroe, and Ken Joseph until we had a first-class proposal that identified the long-term objectives, the targets to be interviewed, the ways in which both the Bureau and the inmates would be protected, and so on. There was a 7-step approval process before an interview would be conducted. For instance, we would have to certify that anyone whom we were about to interview was not currently going through an appeal. For another instance, we would confine our interviews to the subjects of crimes for which the inmate had previously been judged guilty. We said we wouldn't spend any Bureau money on the interviews, for they would be done as adjuncts to the road schools we regularly conducted. The memo went out in late 1978 over Ken's signature to John McDermott at Bureau headquarters in Washington, an official who was in the top ranks of men just under Director Clarence Kelly. McDermott was known throughout the Bureau as the Radish, because he was beet red above the starched white collar, probably due to high blood pressure, which itself had to have been in reaction to the difficulty of serving under Hoover for so long. The Radish looked at what we had styled the Criminal Personality Research Project, which included the information that the pilot had been going on for the previous 18 months, and turned it down flat. In the first place, he wrote, the whole idea was ridiculous. The FBI's job was to catch criminals, get them to court, and incarcerate them. Our job was not to do something that a social worker could and should do. We weren't sociologists and shouldn't be. If criminals were to be sympathetically interviewed, that could be done by academics. There was no Bureau tradition of doing something so outrageous as interviewing killers. And besides that, due to the adversarial relationship we had always enjoyed with the criminal fraternity, the Radish was dead certain that the criminals wouldn't talk to us anyway. The Radish's response was completely characteristic and in keeping with the Bureau attitude of the 1940s when he had come up under Hoover. The fact that I had managed to interview a dozen convicted killers, that they had talked freely to me, and that the Bureau had thereby gained some insight into criminal behavior was totally ignored. Tradition held no precedent for this sort of action, and if there was no precedent, the action could not possibly be any good. One of my objectives in the memo had been to involve outside authorities on criminal behavior and abnormal psychology, and the Radish didn't like that either, because it went against the old Bureau attitude that no outsider could ever teach us anything of value. That posture was absurd, as was the Radish's whole response. But once he had said no to the memo, the project was dead. Grace Hopper's rule had come home with a vengeance. I couldn't do any more prisoner interviews. So I simply waited until the Radish had retired and Clarence Kelly had been replaced by the forward-looking William Webster. By this point, Ken Joseph himself had also retired, but our new administrative head, James McKenzie, was enthusiastic about the project. McKenzie was the youngest man ever to reach the level of assistant director, and his rise toward the top was an indication of his abilities and his understanding of the bureaucracy. What McKenzie did was resubmit the memo to Webster with very few changes. The new director had been given a mandate to take the FBI in a new direction, and he had talked about collaborating with outside experts and about breaking into previously uncharted areas. His initial response to the memo was to want to hear more, and he invited me, McKenzie, and Monroe to a working lunch in his office. The lunch was held in a mid-sized conference room adjacent to the director's office, one of those bland